You set off on a journey of self-improvement. You practice patience in mountain monasteries. You discovered discipline running across the driest deserts and found your focus beneath the surface of frozen lakes while squashed into someone's armpit on the train. There's more to imagine when you listen. Discover self-development titles on Audible. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Drop in the Gloves. Thanks for joining us here. We got an interesting one today, not your typical episode. We have some scheduling stuff going on, some stuff happening in our lives. We had to punt on an episode today and yesterday, but we'll get back into it this week, probably Thursday for another episode. But in the meantime, I've been sitting on this interview I did with Tim Hunter for a while now. I don't know if all of you know, but I did a YouTube series a while back called Pound for Pound. I thought it was a great idea. I sit down with these fighters, new, old, and we just kind of chop it up. We have an interesting conversation about, I thought it was interesting, about, you know, some fights, their lives, their mindset, their thought process going into fights and how they see things. Some guys loved fighting. Some guys didn't like fighting, and just kind of just talk about mano a mano. You know, I was a fighter and it was, you know, I think I can commiserate with them, and I loved it. I loved doing it. We did, I think, 5 or 6 episodes. We had LaRocque and McGrattan, I think, Biz came on, Revo, you know, some pretty tough guys, some well-known guys. And I was hoping to do a season 2, so I started taping for season 2. And lo and behold, as it typically happens with our show, we couldn't find a sponsor. We had some people kicking the tires a little bit, but it just didn't work out. So I've been sitting on this Tim Hunter interview for 2 years now. So I don't know exactly what we talk about, but yeah, I listened to a little bit of it. So if there's stuff that's not relevant, I apologize. It just kind of is what it is. Tim Hunter's an interesting guy, Stanley Cup winner with the Calgary Flames in 1980, you know, tough as nails guy, kind of do whatever you need for him to do on the team. So yeah, check it out. It's a great interview. We'll get back to a regular episode on Thursday or Friday of this week and hopefully back to normal the following week. So yes, I apologize for this. Not having a current events one because there's lots to talk about. There's lots going on in hockey, so I'm very excited to get back later this week, but I appreciate your guys' support. Check out this interview with Tim Hunter. It's actually a very, very good one. He's an interesting guy, and we will catch up with you guys later this week. Cheers. Hey, everybody, welcome to season 2 of Pound for Pound. I did not think we would make it, but here we are. And I am thrilled to be talking to Tim Hunter, everybody. It's an unbelievable opportunity. We don't get many Stanley Cup champions here on the show, let alone Stanley Cup champions who play the type of game that I like to play, rough, tumble, in your face, you know, work hard, all that type of thing. So, Tim, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Pleasure to be on here. Glad to meet you. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure for me, of course, maybe not for you. Yeah, we got connected by hockey fights. You are obviously, you know, a hockey fighter. You've been known to throw the fists around, but you're more than that. You're a hockey player. You played in the NHL for 15 years. You won a Stanley Cup with the Calgary Flames in 1989. I've never won a Stanley Cup. I've only played 3 playoff games. I won them all, by the way, with the Chicago Blackhawks. Joe Quenneville took me out for game 7. Versus Vancouver, and we lost in game 7. Biggest mistake of his career, I would imagine. Can you talk about that run? Can you talk about that run that you guys made? Because, you know, you were well into your career. You were, what, 7-8 years into your career at that point. Did you guys expect to win the Stanley Cup with the Edmonton Oilers just with that juggernaut team that they had?
Well, once we, you know, the fear was getting out of the first round. Vancouver was... We knew we had our hands full right away and, you know, went to game 7. But once we got out of the first round, we just started to build momentum and gain confidence. And, I mean, we had a great team. We had the best record. We had won the President's Trophy, everything. But, you know, you got to just kind of get yourself going. And that's what our team needed. And once we beat Vancouver, that was it. we knew we were going to win. We knew going into Montreal game six, we were going to win in Montreal and bring the Stanley Cup home. We just felt that confident. You know, that team was built to win a Stanley Cup. Cliff Fletcher had done an unbelievable job of putting all the pieces in place, you know, and starting with the base, the group of us that grew up together and lost in 86 to Montreal. And then we learned from all that. We had John Tinelli join our team and teach us a little bit about what it was like to win. And that Stanley Cup team had never had anyone on it that had won a Stanley Cup before. So we're all first timers. And nowadays everyone's looking for that Stanley Cup experience to help pass it on to the guys that are trying to win one for the first time. So it was incredible. We got great performances out of our best players and then lots of good performances out of guys that just chipped in. Patterson's, McDonald's, Hunter's, Poplinski's, Otto's, these guys, it was incredible. But Gilmore, McGinnis, Mullen, Lube, Neuendijk, Roberts, they were the big guns for us and they all played great. So hell of a ride, and you know, it's something you never forget. And every time a team wins, it's all about how close the guys were, how much they cared for each other and how little they wanted to let each other down. And that was the hallmark of any winning team are those things. And everyone talks about how close they are when they win. And that was us. We all grew up together and it was fun. And you know, you're friends with those guys for the rest of your life. You play with a lot of guys you're friends with, but you just are always a little bit closer with guys you've won with.
Was it, you're a Calgary, you're born in Calgary. You grew up in Calgary.
Yeah.
You played for the Seattle Breakers in the WHL, which I didn't even know the Seattle Breakers existed, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
What was that? That's got to be the coolest feeling ever. Your family must have been there. Your friends must have been there. Was it just like a blur once you won that cup, just ripping around town?
Oh, yeah. You know, and so I was drafted by the Atlanta Flames and then was in Atlanta actually getting a knee operation at David Poile's place when they announced they're moving the team to Calgary. So that was the cool part of it. And to go and play in your hometown, and Mike Vernon was another guy, was hometown guy, Dana Mers. And so pretty special. And yeah, you know, in those days, they didn't have a keeper for the cup. So the city that won the cup got the cup. So the cup was in Calgary all the time.
No.
So I had the cup. I had the cup for like a week. I got the cup on a Wednesday and I took it back on a Monday. And I took it everywhere. I had a, you know, a single cab pickup, bench seat, like a 1980 Chev pickup. So I go down and pick the cup up. And the gal, the receptionist, says, it's over there. And I look and there's a hockey bag, a Flame hockey bag. I said, she goes, yeah, it's in the bag. So I unzip the bag and there's the Stanley Cup in a hockey bag.
No
way.
I'm like,
holy mackerel. So I go, okay, well, I'll see you Monday when I bring it back. So I go out to my truck to put it in my truck and I'm going, how, you know, I didn't have a canopy on the back. And I'm like, I thought the thing might roll around. I said, screw it. I put it in the seat, the passenger seat. I put the seatbelt around it and I drove around town. People would be driving there and be like, hey, there's Tim Hunter. And there's the Stanley Cup. Like, unbelievable. So I took it to all kinds of friends' places. I had some buddies were firefighters. I took it to the hospital. Some friends had some restaurants. Took it and, you know, all kinds of different things like that. And, you know, and then I had a big party at my house, family and friends and childhood coaches and all those people in Calgary. And it was just like, it was almost more than just my backyard. It was like a block party. And so it was incredible. And, you know, I see the cup now and I see all these celebrations and Phil Pritchard, you know, parades it around. He takes a case, he polishes it off, takes it to somebody's house and they have 4 or 5 hours with it. And then off they go, you know. And for me, I was like, I was spoiled. You know, I went to Tyler Bozak's celebration in Regina. I knew Tyler in Toronto, coached him and friendly with his parents who have a place out the lake in Moose Jaw where I lived. For and so they invited me to the cup, and you know, they bring it in and they had it there for like from 1 to 5, and then boom, they got to go somewhere else. And yeah, so you know, I think we were spoiled back then and pretty lucky. And you know, we did stupid things like take the bottom off it, unscrewed the bottom on it, wrote stuff on the inside, and you know, like it's got a wood base on it, you know. And I think there's a couple of them, to be honest. But
yeah.
So there's all kinds of different writing in there, Sharpies, guys putting their names and all this crazy stuff. You know, I should have taken some pictures back then, but, you know, because the internet wasn't the worldwide way it is now, you know.
So you're the reason why there's a cup guy now who travels around with a 24/7.
Pretty much. Well, I think it was those guys that lost it in their pool. And were the guys that took it to the strip joint in Edmonton. I think it was those guys.
It was them, not you, Tim. Not you.
Not me. Well, Patterson, Colin Patterson, so he wanted to have a party in Toronto that summer, later in the summer. So he asked if he could get the cup out there. And it never traveled like that. So Phil's first job was to take the cup to Patterson's place.
Hmm.
So Patter's got his street all blocked off. And he's having all his family friends and childhood friends. And this guy comes pulling up in this Toyota. He's going, no, go wait. The street's blocked off. You can't come up here. He goes, no, I'm so-and-so. He goes, I don't care. The street's blocked off. You can't come in here. He goes, no, I got the Stanley Cup. It's in my car. Oh, come on in. So that's kind
funny.
Of the start of all that, you know, and now it's like, it's a big show, which, you know, sometimes you get a little, miffed about it because, you know, it was like when you win it, the players, the only guys that touch it, the team, the managers, coaches that won it, they get to hold it and raise it, drink out of it, and have it. Yeah. Now they also commercialized and you can win a day with the cup and all this stuff. I'm like, no, you can't do that. It's not right. But
yeah, it kind of loses its mystique almost a little bit when there's just Joe Schmo
forcing
it over his head. Yeah, I didn't touch it. I had the opportunity to. Wish I would have won it, but let's transition here. This is the pound for pound. We'll get back to more personal stuff in a second. It's interesting kind of picking your brain. I want to go over one of your earlier fights with Dave Semenko. Now talk about the Battle of Alberta. You were obviously Calgary. He was Edmonton. His job was to protect their stars, Yari Curry, Mark Messier, obviously Wayne. They have Paul Coffey, those guys. I want to just talk about the mentality you're going into that game. You were a young guy. I think it was your first or second year. Do you know you got to mix it up with Semenko? Is it your goal to get under his skin? Is it your goal to get in Gretzky's grill? Like, what do you do preparing for that game, knowing that you got Semenko staring across the ring from you?
Well, I'll take you back a little bit. The year before, when I was in the minors, I was playing in 2 years before that. I was playing in Birmingham, Alabama, Central Hockey League, it's called then. And Dave Semenko got injured, got sent down to Wichita. And John Muck was coaching down there. And they've got a pretty big team and a bunch of pretty tough guys. So Dave Semenko comes down. He's wearing Wichita win. He's got 99, number 99.
No.
Playing the minors. Oh, yeah. And big show. And Dave's, you know, and I knew he was legitimate tough guy, and I'm like, so I didn't really, you know, I was a defenseman in the minors and he was a left winger, and so I didn't really never fought him or anything, but you know, came close. Funny stuff. So I knew what I was up against when I was going in to play in the corral when I was playing the Oilers the first time, and I just thought, you know, let's see how he reacts. I banged a few guys and, you know, and then we finally come together and I knew he was Dave only fought about 60 times. He didn't fight 200 times. Like I, you know, not a lot of guys wanted to fight. Dave was number one, very tough and very mean and very dirty. You know, he kicked me in that fight.
Yeah.
Kneed me.
Sucker Joe.
You know, yeah, all kinds of different things. Well, he suckered me over the ref lines and hit me right in the forehead.
Yeah.
No helmet on. And then Jim Plinski jumped in. So,
yeah.
You know, Dave, just when you thought, and that was the second I knew, there's no code. There's no code with Dave Semenko. He's going to let you know. And I laughed when I talked to Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier, these guys, about this stuff. I said, you know, Semenko, he gave you a quick let's go or don't fuck around, excuse the language. And if you didn't, he just drilled you and then you had to fight. So you better be ready. And so that fight, you know, I thought I did pretty well. I got him and I crossed and I hit him with some laughs. And he always says, you know, Tim Hunter's throwing those pillows left, you know, whatever, you know, I could see him coming from last week type of thing. And he had that in his book and it's funny stuff, but I thought I did pretty good. And he, obviously for him to have to take a shot at me at the end of the fight like that, he must have felt he didn't do very well and he wanted to get one last lick.
I wanted to talk about that because you mentioned the code and all the fighters talk about it. It's like, you don't hit a guy when he's down. You don't hit a guy when he's tied up with the ref. You got to respect your opponent. You were a young kid in the league. Did that change the way you played moving forward that you're like, okay, well, Semenko, who's known in the league, is going to throw a sucker punch. Like, did you start doing that? Were you more aware of that moving forward to kind of just maybe watch out for these guys?
Well, I didn't really change much, but I just knew that you better be prepared and don't, you know, I kind of looked at him a little cocky, like over like this. And he's like, oh yeah, really? Here you go. Take this. Cause you know, he wasn't tied up by the linesman. And I kind of knew that, you know, you have to be careful. And I approached that through 90% of all my fights, basically was my mentality was to not lose. Yeah. I fought to not lose. I didn't fight to win. I fought to not lose and make sure that a guy that I fought knew he was in a fight. And because the worst thing is to lose a fight. And you are could look through all the fight tapes and you're going to find that you're not going to find me laying on the ice, knocked out or made up, you know, fallen down and brought a guy down with me or something, but not where I've lost and the guy skates away and I'm still laying. You aren't going to find it.
Yeah, and you were mostly outmatched size wise, even like with the McSorleys, with the Proberts, with the Semenkos. We talked to Chris Nyland a year ago, and he was always outmatched. Did you have a strategy going into it, knowing that you're giving up size and reach and weight and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, well, I knew, you know, I played 2 years in the minors at defense. I got called up, played my first game against the Boston or the Philadelphia Flyers, and I played left wing. So I kind of figured going forward, I was going to be a forward and I was probably going to have to fight.
Yeah.
You know, John Brophy told me my first year pro, he says, Tim, you got two choices to make the NHL. You either be the best defenseman in the CHL or the meanest motherfucker in the CHL. And he says, I think number two is your chance. I said, John, how about I try both? He goes, good luck.
So good luck, Tim.
I just thought, you know, if I can play and I can improve and I can contribute, I'm not gonna mind fighting. You know, and especially fighting for the right reason. I never fought just to get a fight in because there's too many guys out there that are tough and you take the wrong approach, you get hit one time, your career could be over.
Yeah, I think people forget that people use fighting as like a means to an end. Like you were a good hockey player. You saw an avenue. It's like, listen, if I don't do this, there's no chance I'll have a career in the NHL as long as you did. And I think people forget that fighters are fairly smart. And I was doing a little digging. Like you were nominated for the King Clancy Award a couple of times, Bill Masterson Award. You won another award with Calgary for your humanitarian work in the city. Are people surprised to hear that when like they look at your PIMS totals, you got thousands of penalty minutes in the NHL. You've got just as many in juniors and stuff. When they meet, you're like, wow, Tim's actually a nice guy. He's not this caged animal who's going to, you know, wants to rip my face off. Is there a lot of people who are just kind of caught off guard by who you are actually? Because they see something on the ice.
In a lot of ways. But I mean, since my playing career's ended and went on to coach 15 years in the NHL as assistant coach, coached the World Junior 3 times, coached in the Western Hockey League 6 years. You know, you're a mentor. You're a real person to young players that want to be hockey players. You're a mentor to young pros that want to have long careers in the NHL. So, you know, you have to have something about you that's calm and compassionate, right?
You think anybody's getting the same advice that you got from Brophy, whether you be the toughest guy in the league or score the most points?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I coached a lot of young, tough guys, you know, Stephen Pete, Colton Orr, Brant Myers, number of guys. And I always told them, The number one thing you're here for is to play. You play, you improve as a player, you're going to have a career. If you just go out there every time you get a shift and you fight, where's that put you? Well, yeah. Okay, you might have won a fight, but you don't improve as a player. So I cannot stand the stage fights. I just play hockey. It obviously is part of the entertainment. You and I know that.
Yeah.
And the managers and the coaches, they kind of use it a little bit. And hey, whatever. No big deal. We know that. But you've got to be smart about it. And that's what I was talking earlier. I trained, once I knew I was going to be a fighter, I trained like a madman to do two things, to become a real good fighter and to become very fit. So I knew I'd have an upper arm on everybody on my team and everybody in the NHL. If I was the fittest guy and I was the best fighter, technically, like I wasn't the toughest guy. I played 196 pounds, 6 foot two. That's all. And I still weigh about the same now, you know, and those guys like McSorley and Semenko, they're 225, 235. Yeah. Donald Brashear, one of the, you know, big guys was 240. Probert, about 220. And all bigger and stronger than me. But I knew how to survive. I knew how to not get hurt, how to disguise my punches, yeah, and how to recognize when a guy's throwing a punch.
Well, you mentioned stamina. I watched a lot of your fights, and that's the one thing I noticed, where you just, it'll be a minute into a fight, and gosh, I can barely lift my arms a minute into a fight. Now, completely frank, that's how guys beat me. Did you do that? Let's talk about another fight. You mentioned Bob Probert. It was January 2nd, 1993. You were with the Nordiques. He was with the Red Wings. It was a marathon fight where you guys went on and on and on, and you were just going back and forth. And he, again, kind of suckers you at the end when he does a little elbow drop. But was that your strategy, you know, trying to tire these guys out and extend the fight as long as you can? Or did it just happen?
You set off on a journey of self-improvement. You practice patience in mountain monasteries. You discovered discipline running across the driest deserts. And found your focus beneath the surface of frozen lakes. While squashed into someone's armpit on the train. There's more to imagine when you listen. Discover self-development titles on Audible. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
No, that's what I tried to do. I tried to extend it out and just kind of in the early going, like a lot of guys really want to get going, they really use a lot of energy to try to get their arm free. And I would just kind of grapple and hold on and wait my time out and dodge a few hits and then try to outlast them. There's another fight that I fought Marty McSorley in LA, and it's about 3 minutes long.
I saw that one too. It's incredible.
That's amazing long fight. So that fight with Probert, I'm playing with Mike Huff, and I'm trying to remember our sentiment. So I get the puck on the coming out of our end on the right wing, and I hear this crowd, and I look back, and Mike Huff is laying on the ice, and Probert skates by, and I'm like, oh geez. So I go straight over to him. And he's looking at me like, and I should have known. He's like, what are you doing? And I just cross-checked. And the referees, the linesman got in real quick, and I got 2 minutes for cross-check. So probably what you don't see in the fight is, like, I'm in the penalty box, and I'm getting ready to come out of the penalty box, the end of my penalty, and he's on the bench, and he's calling the other left winger off so he can come on the ice, meet me on the ice.
Holy moly, Tim.
This is
terrified?
His first time. No. I was, you know, I'd fought him only one time before, and I fought him early in his career in Detroit, and I hit him so hard. I've never hit anyone that hard, and he didn't even blink an eye. I just went, oh boy, this guy's can take a punch. But I don't know what he would have been doing in those days is because he had a bit of a reputation for, you know, being a little bit of a wild man off the ice. So anyway, I come out of the penalty box, and there's Probert skating across the ice at me. I'm going, oh boy. So I want to get my stick out, get a little distance so I can get organized, you know. So I just kind of spear him, like, you know, and then we dropped the gloves and went. But like, this is probably his first fight in 6 or 7 months, because he got like a 6-month suspension from the NHL for doing something. I'm not sure what it was. And it's his first 1 or 2 games back in Canada after being banned from playing in Canada. Yeah. So he's like a caged animal. I'm going, oh boy. So, but like, I was never, you know, you talk about trepidation, you know, anxiety. I was never afraid to fight anybody.
No kidding.
Because I knew that if I just did my thing, I could survive and I wouldn't get hurt, you know? So I just went, okay, here we go. So anyways, the funny part of it, I go in the dressing room after the period, and I said, the boys are going, hey, Hunts, it wasn't Probert that hit Huff. It was Dallas Drake. And I'm like, come on. Come on. I'm going, oh, boy, what a mistake, right? You know, so one of those things that it just, that's the way it went, you know.
So how, but,
you know, it's like.
I was a nervous wreck before every fight. I'll be honest. I've talked to like George LaRocque. I talked to him. He speaks openly about how scared he was before every fight. And George was like the biggest, baddest guy in the block for years. I can't wrap my head around how you're not afraid when Bob Probert's staring at you from across the ice saying, I'm going to rip your face. Like, how was that possible? I'm 6'8", 265 pounds when I played, and I still got nervous fighting guys every time. I don't understand that.
I'll tell you, if I had your size, I would have been a killer. I would have just mopped the league up. With my mentality and my way I trained and the way I trained in box with Willie DeWitt.
Yeah.
Willie DeWitt was the Canadian champion heavyweight. So in Calgary, we had a bunch. We'd go Reinhardt, Poplinski, myself, Risebrough, and we'd train with them in the morning with this trainer and do, you know, do everything to last 3-4 rounds in a boxing ring. And like all the heavy bag, the speed bag, all the medicine ball stuff, sit-ups and all that. So I was like, you know, really confident in myself. So yeah. That was the big thing, you know, not, I guess it's more confident that I could survive than being nervous or afraid. Like, I've never really been afraid of anything.
Jeez.
I've never met a grizzly in the wild, but I think I would be if I met one in the wild.
In that Probert fight, you guys were grappling like crazy, and it almost was like the first guy to get undressed wins the fight. Back then, there was no tie downs. There was no anything to keep the jerseys, the shoulder pads, the old pads on. When you fought guys like Bob and Rob Ray and these guys who they wanted to get undressed, what would you do to keep them in there? Marty McSorley was always out of his gear.
Yeah.
Did you go in there being like, you know what? I can't let this guy get loose. What would you do to kind of combat that?
Well, I had a big jersey on then too. I had big extension sleeves on that Quebec jersey. I had them all custom gussets put in and everything by the trainers. And, you know, just so, you know, you were pulling it, it was coming straight out. It was coming off. What I tried to do was I grabbed guys right in the elbow area on the inside, and I'd grab and I'd twist so I could squeeze the sweater on their arms so it wouldn't come off easy. I could hold the sweater on their arms. And like I had, every training camp I was in for 18 years in the 16 in the NHL and 2 in the minors, they always did that grip strength. I had the strongest grip on every team I ever played for. So I could hold on for dear life, like nobody's business. So I had really, really good grip strength. And I just would wait, get the jersey. I fought Matt Johnson one time. He's 6'5", 235, and he was begging me, come on, we got to go. My coach wants me to kick the shit out of you. I'm going, you're not going to kick the shit out. I said, good luck. I said, have a couple shifts, and then maybe we'll fight. You know, I said, I've had more fights than you've had shifts and stuff like this. I just, the poor kid was just frothing at the mouth to fight me. So I fought him. I got him. Comes in, and he's kind of reaching. So I get both his arms, and I pull him together, and I grab his two arm jerseys right in the middle, and I'm holding both his arms and I'm hitting him with left.
No.
And then the fight broke up, and I go, dude, 6'5", 235, where was it? And I skated away.
No way.
Yeah. He was just handcuffed. He didn't know what to do.
Did you see the progression of guys getting bigger and bigger, but they got worse as fighting? Because it seems like there was a time when they just took the biggest guys and threw them on skates and threw them out there, and they couldn't skate at all. And yeah. Did you see that? You were just licking your chop. Like a guy like Matt Johnson, he grew up in St. Catharines, where I grew up. I know him. I've seen him in the gym. He's a big human, but he won't be, you know, you're not going to confuse him with a guy winning a skating championships. Did you see that, like, growing, like, as the, because you played for a long time?
Well, yeah, like, you know, in the beginning, the biggest guys were Dave Semenko, Glenn Cochran. I got fought Glenn Cochran in my first game.
Dave Brown was out there, first,
Dave Brown later on. It's just like bigger guys, and like, you know, Jim Kite was a big guy, he was bigger than me. And Jim was pretty tough, pretty good fighter. I fought Jim probably more than anybody. He was, John Ferguson was there, and he was like, and if, you know, if somebody couldn't, you know, we got Jim Kite into Calgary, and we had Stu Grimson. And so they thought that, you know, like, I was doing okay. I didn't kick shit out of anybody, but they wanted somebody to beat up Dave Semenko and Marty McSorley. And you're not going to do that. So they thought, well, Jim Kite, like, first they tried with Stu Grimson, and I was trying to teach Stu, you know, like, so he was going to fight Dave Brown. And I'm like, be careful. I said, Dave doesn't miss with his punch. So don't be trading rights with lefts. It won't end well, pal. So he got a good fight. He got going and sort of won the first fight, and then they fought a little while later. I remember the timeline, and Dave Brown broke his orbital bone.
I remember I talked to Stu about that. Yeah.
Yeah. He, and I said, Stewie, I said, do not trade punches with Dave Brown. He does not miss. And when he hits you with that piston, it's going to hurt. And man. So then they brought Jim Kite, and I told Jim the same thing. I said, I always got you when I crossed with you and I threw lefts on you. I said, that's when you had trouble because you couldn't throw lefts. I said, so you got to make sure you either are timing it or not, but don't let him just throw lefts and you're going to try to throw rights and beat him. Same thing. Jim broke his orbital bone. Jim Brown broke Jim's orbital bone.
So in your
like right there.
Your 16-year career, who was the guy who gave you a little bit of nerves where you had to, like, really just, okay, I got to watch myself versus this guy or it could go bad?
Yeah, there's the only guy was Nick Fetillo.
Nick Fetillo.
So Nick Fetillo, he was only about my size, but he was like 230. He was thick, and he had these big Popeye's arms, man. They were just massive forearms. So my first game in Madison Square Gardens, I beat up Don Maloney. And I don't know why Don wanted to fight me, but, you know, I'm playing and somehow he wants to fight. And I'm going, okay, Nick Fetillo's coming over the boards at any time. So game goes on, no Nick. So we score to make it 3 or 4-2 late in the game. And 37 seconds or 47, whatever, it's under a minute left. Bob Johnson sends me out right wing. Over comes Nick Fetillo, and I'm going, oh shit. I thought I was going to get out of here alive. No, 30 under a minute. I said, now I'm going to die. So this guy is, because I knew he was Golden Glove boxing guy. So I knew he knew how to punch and he was very powerful. So hard to control as a fighter. And if he does hit you, whether you got a helmet on or not, it's going to hurt. Right. So I had to be careful. So I was going, okay. So face off, referee drops the puck. He spears me right inside my leg, right in the groin area, right in that tender flesh, between your hamstring and your quad. Right. And I'm like, oh God, and now I can't stand up and I have to fight this guy. So he steps back and he gives me this one, drops his gloves. He goes, come here. So I'm stupid, young, and I'm going, okay, I gotta get this. I got to get this over with. So I take a couple steps toward him, and he reaches out and grabs me and just pulls me in, and I'm coming at him, and I just duck my head. He hit me right on top of my CCM helmet, and it blew off, and I've never seen it since. I don't know where it went. It just, but I was just like, oh man. And I got all organized and went to the ice and went, okay, thank God that's over. So later on, you know, I seen Nick some fights. And so later on, we got him in Calgary, and because, you know, that helped me out because I didn't really have anyone else. It was, you know, they tried all these other guys. And so they got Nick in Calgary. Nick wanted to fight. You know, he wanted to show everyone that he could fight and help the team. And so we're playing in Vancouver, and they have Craig Cox there, Coxie. I don't know if you've ever seen it. He's had some great fights with Probert and very, very, but he's like this Scooby-Doo guy.
Yeah.
So he goes, hey, Hunts, let's go. I said, sure. Okay. No problem. You know, we're beating Vancouver, and I thought I'll fight him. And I'm getting ready to drop my gloves, and Nick comes in, he pulls me out of the way. He goes, Hunts, I'll take care of this. I went, oh, okay, go ahead. So he's going like this, and Nick hits Coxie, breaks his left orbital bone right away, right off the get-go, hits him with the right. Coxie's like, whoa, dude, that's a heavy punch. And I'm like going, how are you not on the ground and out cold? I'll never know. And he continued to fight him, and they fought. And Coxie had a broken orbital bone. He fought the rest of the fight.
He's one of the most underrated heavyweights, just nicest guy. He lives in Traverse City, where I live, and I see him around the way sometimes.
Oh, he does.
The greatest guy. Like, just.
Well, you ever see him, say hello to him. He was fun to play with, because eventually I played with him later on. But so my point of that story was, when Nick hit him in the face, I went, 7 or 8 years earlier, I went, that could have been me if I didn't duck. And that would have not have been very, very nice, because, you know, that's not what you want, you know, like, because a lot of those guys, I know Stu, you know, good for him to go on and continue on after he broke his orbital bone, to keep on pounding away and doing what he did and having a long career, you know, to fight, because a lot of guys get real timid after something like that. And Stu didn't, neither did Coxie, you know, he just kept on, you know, that's how he was.
Well, yeah, when you get your face smashed in, you get a little gunshot. All right, a couple more questions. What's your most memorable? I know your most memorable moment's probably staying like, this is a fighting show. What's your most memorable fight when someone's like, hey, Tim, what's your best fight? Who was it? Where was it?
My most memorable one, because it was, I fought Rob Ray in Buffalo.
Razor.
And he goes and... it's hard to tell in the fight because you can't really see. It's hard to tell, but I gave him the pretzel. It's a hold I have. So guy puts his arms out. He wants to fight you. And he wants to grab you. So I take my right and I put it over his arm, and his arm goes underneath mine. And then I squeeze his arm. I grab his left, and then I feed him left. So it's like a Chinese handcuff. He can't get his arm out. I've got it pinched against me, and I'm pulling him in both his right arm, and I'm feeding him with lefts. So I did that to Rob Ray. And he was like, he didn't know what hit him. He had no idea what I just did to him. He couldn't punch, and I was just feeding him. He goes to the penalty box. He kicks his helmet. He's totally pissed. And later on, I heard the trainers, he was in the hallway. He was just swearing to beat a band. He just had no idea what happened to him.
Was that a plan? How did you do that?
Yeah, it was a plan. Yeah, I tried it with a few guys in practice, and I thought, okay. And I tried it a couple times, and I got a few hits in, but I didn't quite get the guy's arm. So you just, as he reaches out with his left arm, you just grab over, squeeze it into you, and now you got it. His arm's underneath your arm, and you hold his right, and now he can't do anything. So you just pull his right. He's trying to now hold your left, but you don't hit him. You just pull it in. So you got both his arms. He's in like this, and he can't hit you.
Yeah,
so that fight probably is the number one, because I really wanted to do that, and I wanted to have success with that, because, like, I, you know, a lot of guys ask me, you know, round guys playing golf, and they're going, what's, you know, some strategy? I said, well, the worst thing to do is if I ever put you in the press. So I'm like, well, what's that? So I says, well, get ready to fight me, put your arms up. So I just wrap their arms up, and they're going like, what? How'd you do that? I got them in that Chinese handcuff where, you know, you just can't get your hand free. And they're going, holy geez. I said, yeah. I said, I did that a couple times, but my favorite was Rob Ray. And I think my other favorite fight is the one with McSorley where it went about 3 minutes. Like he was, you know, always had a hard time with him because he's so big.
Yeah.
And that one, I really got a lot of good licks in, and he was frustrated that it went on so long. And I just kept on dodging and crossing and hitting him with lefts. And he, because he wasn't technically a great fighter. He's just a big, brawny guy. Right.
Yeah.
But so that would be the other one.
What's your worst fight where you're like, I don't want to watch that again?
I'm not sure. I think Adam Deadmarsh.
No kidding. Adam Deadmarsh.
Yeah. One time in Colorado when I was in Vancouver, and I was like, I just didn't think this guy was, I took him lightly.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen him fight before. And man, and he was he's a little bit like me, like not really big guy, but you know, maybe 6'1" and yeah, that. And I think, one time I fought Stefan Kintel, who was really tough.
No kidding.
And, in St. Louis, and he did the same thing. He was, you know, he like double crossed me. Like, you know, I was doing this and and the next thing I'm going, oh man, he knew what he was doing. So I had, you know, he hit me a couple times in the side. The number one thing you learn when you're boxing is you make your face as small as possible.
Yeah.
You're never looking at a guy like that. You've got to tilt your head. But, you know, I'm trying in this. And then when I go here, I didn't quite get changed. And I still had my head hit me a couple times over here. So I was like, damn, not good. You know? So, yeah, but nothing, no damage or anything. It's just technically, I just wasn't prepared and wasn't on my A game.
It's interesting listening to you talk. Like you were a student of fighting. Like you knew you had a game plan. You knew what you were trying to do. You went out and you kind of implemented it. Like even just that, like tilting your head, making yourself as small as possible. That's like next level stuff. Like that's pretty impressive. Well,
you know, and then I wore some Vaseline over my eyes because I called it, you know, a lot of guys, you know, they'd go, Hunts, where's the Vaseline? Cause I said, you mean the instant courage? They go, what? Yeah. You know, it makes you tougher when you got Vaseline because if you get hit there, you know, it just glances off and you know, no one will ever know you got hit, right? So I used to tease guys and call it instant courage. So before the game, I'd go in there, I'm putting on some instant courage, boys. Don't worry.
We got it.
Back. They'd all laugh.
That's too funny. I remember guys would put tough skin on their hands to make them stickier. So they would cut guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was... there's all the kinds of tricks of the trade.
Or Donnelly wore surgical gloves a couple times. And
how was that allowed?
He was, well, he wasn't. He all of a sudden he'd fight and hit a guy a few times. And then on the way to the box, he'd rip him off and stuff him in his pants or something, you know. I tried to catch him with it, but never could do it. So, yeah, there's some guys that had some. Tony Twist was really tough. And Tony, his jersey didn't come off, but he had his jersey sewn up with one single thread, like really light thread. So just his arm. So his right arm was just sewn up. You grabbed his right arm, it was like, oops, gone. Now you have nothing. You can't hold on. There's no sleeve there. Because it's just wide open. So now he's flailing away. So he was, he was in Quebec when I was in Quebec.
Did you have anybody who checked the, like, cause nowadays you couldn't do that. They check your equipment. They check the jerseys. It all has to be in regular. Was it just a free for all? You would get your jersey and just start tinkering with it.
Yeah, for sure.
Ugh.
Kelly Buckberger, I fought him the first time and he's a big tall guy.
Yeah, he's a big dude.
And, he got, you know, we all had our tie downs in the back.
Yeah.
Well, he got in front of me and he pushed my jersey up over my face. And now I can't see because I got this jersey in front of me. And I was, yeah, it was a little bit awkward. So after that, I had a jersey tied on the front and one in the back. So I didn't, you know, and then I had just the big sleeve. So my arm would come out or they couldn't hold on and I could still hit because I had the big sleeve.
Yeah.
So lots of guys had different. I know, you know, like it's famous, that story about Brown when he fought Grimson. He had the trainer stick him on the inside of his equipment so his sweater would stick to his equipment and the lube on there. So when he grabbed, he couldn't get a hold of his left. And Brownie was just feeding Stu lefts and Stu couldn't do anything about it.
Oh, man.
You know, like that's the one thing I always had a lot of respect for Dave Brown because he was smart and he was, you know, he was mean. Like you pissed him off. Oh, boy. I fought him a few times and did okay. And but I knew that I had to be careful not to get hit by his left because he had that heavy punch like Nick Fetio. It could do some damage.
Yeah. Well, listen, Tim, are you going to get back into coaching? Kind of wrap this thing up. What's Tim Hunter doing with the next 25 years of his life?
I'm retired. I thought if I make the 60 coaching and staying busy in hockey, that'd be 40 years in hockey. I'm going to retire. So at 60, I retired. I've been down in Arizona 2 years now in the winter. I moved back to Calgary. I didn't move back there for the winter. I moved back there for the summer and the fall and the spring so I could watch the Flames in the early part of the season and hopefully watch them in the late part and in the playoffs. And it's looking like I might be able to do that this year.
Looking like a real good team this year. Well, listen, Tim, I really appreciate you taking up some of your time. I know you're busy. You got to golf. You're on the course right now. I wish I was there, but I really appreciate it. It's a really big honor to talk to my friend. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John. My pleasure talking to you and pleasure meeting you as well.
Likewise. All right, everybody. Tim Hunter, glad you watched. Cheers, everybody.
You turned your dating app for pets into a business, which just turned over its first billion. You turned around the fortunes of a failing football club, politely turned down a Nobel Peace Prize, and turned up on Mars in your own reusable rocket. While struggling to turn on the dishwasher, there's more to imagine when you listen. Discover business development titles on Audible. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.